Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have...
Welcome to Nation's Last. On the Progressive Radio Network, it's MBL on PRN.FM, this April 5th, 2016 edition, episode 84 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico with our live studio audience. Settle down. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. If you hate this song, you can play the flip side, which is called...
E-Race.
E-Race.
As in extinction and the race to it.
Ah, very catchy tune as well. This is a call-in show. Please prepare those questions and get ready to give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. This is also a call-out show. Or as suggested by Mark, it's a laugh-out show. Today we'll take issue with the nonprofit industrial complex. We are joined by Canadian independent journalist Corey Morningstar. Welcome, Corey, and thanks for joining us. Okay, great.
Okay, Corey's even more soft-spoken than usual.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll go ahead and start without you, Corey. We'll let you catch up later. Most people believe the nonprofit sector is providing important services and making no money in the process. That's sometimes true, but as is often the case, there is more to this situation than meets the eye. We'll look a little deeper at this issue on today's show.
Let's start with an explanation, as always, of what we're trying to accomplish with this and other upcoming episodes. We use this format about once each month. We started 4 months ago with an episode focused on Michael Mann and his work. We followed up with critiques of Catherine Hayhoe, Naomi Klein, and last month, Bill McKibben. In every case, we've informed them in advance of our motives and asked them to join us on the show. And then to rub it in, we sent them a link to the show after it aired. Today, we'll continue our efforts to dig below the surface. But instead of focusing on a specific individual, we will concentrate on an entire sector, the nonprofit industrial sector. And it's described by Corey at Wrong Kind of Green, and Art of Annihilation. We complain about the mainstream media being bought by special interest groups like those who run the fossil fuel industry. We rarely complain when our experts are tied to an institution, organization, business, or even a paycheck. The fact that someone is giving them a paycheck should be a red flag. Not everyone gets a paycheck. I don't. Guy doesn't. Corey doesn't. In fact, none of the major contributors to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network receive a paycheck. We are not on the payroll at PRN. Nor have they ever asked us to edit or censor our content. There are no sponsors on PRN. We are not governed by the FCC. We can say whatever the fuck we want, when we want. Today, we continue our series of episodes focused on leading scientists and public figures who have major voices. Today, we're going beyond individuals, but still focusing on the primary source of news for most people. These people and groups are vital to the flow of information heard by most people. We're not saying they have all been bought. We are saying they are censored, whether it be by the institution or organization they work for, or self-censorship in response to potential action taken against them. They are paid. We are not. With this episode and others in the future, we will highly encourage anyone who receives significant airtime on major media outlets to become what we call free agents. This isn't to say that you can't have a job or make an income. We are, however, saying that if you are a leading voice in environmental protection, social justice, or climate science, your voice and your word are suspect. In order to become a trusted member of Information Exchange, a sacrifice is required. Actually, it only feels like a sacrifice until you've taken the steps we have taken. Leaving the institution or organization that pays you will set you free and give the public a reliable voice. We here at NBL are not well-known or leading voices in the mainstream media, yet we have taken steps to be considered reliable voices. Please join us in supporting those who must take such a step. The echo chamber must become quiet.
Let's start with a little background information. Nonprofit means nobody makes money, right? Well, actually, no. Nonprofit means the organization doesn't have shareholders who make money. The organization itself doesn't turn a financial profit. However, the employees are paid, and sometimes quite handsomely. The CEO of the United Way made the news a few years ago when his enormous salary was made public. According to Charity Watch, at least 17 CEOs working for nonprofit organizations draw paychecks in excess of $1 million per year. Kristen Samper, who heads the Wildlife Conservation Society, and Carter Roberts of the World Wildlife Fund top the list for conservation-minded nonprofits at just under $1 million each. I worked with Carter Roberts during my one-year stint with the Nature Conservancy between the summers of 1999 and 2000. He was instrumental in connecting with big money players and also extracting funds from them. Specifically, Carter Roberts obtained a multi-million dollar gift from an individual to fund the postdoctoral program I administered. I was the inaugural director of the David H. Smith Conservation Fellows Program. It is currently housed within the Society for Conservation Biology. I'd like to talk a little bit about my time with Big Green. I'm using the Nature Conservancy as an example only because I don't have other personal examples. I suspect the Nature Conservancy is not substantially better or worse than many other conservation organizations in the nonprofit sector. During one of my midlife crises, I came to realize that the University of Arizona was addicted to economic growth. The university, like all other colleges and universities, valued money more than education, service to society, or any of the other values it proclaimed as worthy pursuits. In response to my midlife realization, I took a one-year leave of absence from the University of Arizona. I worked for the Nature Conservancy during this time. It didn't take long to conclude the cancer I observed at the university afflicted Big Green, too. During my short stint with the Nature Conservancy, they completed the transition from a 90-10 model to a 99-1 model, whereas the previous goal was to receive 90% of their financial support from 10% of their members, the new goal was to obtain 99% of their financial support from 1% of the members. More than a decade and a half later, I suspect the current goal is even more unbalanced than it was then.
You can imagine some of the consequences when an organization focuses intently on fewer than 1% of the members, and those are the members with a lot of money. You wind up with a mentality that's all about financial elite.
In addition, the nonprofit sector has echoed the pattern commonly reported in the federal government, especially with respect to the big banks. These two entities, the federal government and the big banks, have become revolving doors for people pulling the strings of empire. Mark Tursek, current president and CEO of the Nature Conservancy, was a managing director and partner for Goldman Sachs, where he spent 24 years. He wrote a best-selling book published 3 years ago titled Nature's Fortune, How Business and Society Thrive by Investing in Nature. In other words, nature itself has become monetized, and that monetization is viewed as uniformly, unquestionably virtuous for nature and also for the financial bottom line. As the CEO of Nestle famously pointed out, water is not a human right, but making money is. On a previous show, we briefly discussed Billy Parrish as an example of the kind of person recruited by the nonprofit industrial complex. His rise to power was truly meteoric. Corey, can you tell us a little bit more about Parrish and extend the example to the entire sector?
Do I just begin wherever?
Yeah, yeah. Jump on, go.
Okay.
And in fact, we have 50 minutes left, so you just have all that time.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think in the last show, we discussed a little bit about today how, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this activism now as anthropocentrism and activists today as anthropocentrists. You know, completely human-centered, all of our actions basically you know, to serve human needs and nothing to do with protecting nature or protecting non-human life in general. Anyway, I was working on the divestment series, and I was researching once again Clinton and Naomi Klein's basically affiliations with the Clinton Foundation, although she, years and years ago, was very upset by Bono. Is that how you pronounce his name? I never know.
Bono.
By his affiliations with the Clinton Foundation, but now she's actually tied herself into those same networks through her affiliation with 350.org and her campaigns. Anyway, when I was looking at doing my research on 350.org, that started with One Sky. But before One Sky and 350 worked together in 2011, everything was being done under the name One Sky. And then in 2007, the Clinton Foundation committed to raise $50 million with partners for One Sky. And I stumbled upon something when doing that research that took me back even prior to that, prior to 2007, what was happening. Like, you know, where did that come from? And prior to 2007, we had Energy Action Coalition, which is another NGO which was founded by Parrish. And I'll continue on with that in a second, but just to say that they committed in 2007, that year, they completely financed the Power Shift campaign, and I'll talk about that again in a second, to the tune of $3 million. So if we even go back before that, to 15 years ago, back to 2001, Phil Radforth, the former executive director of Greenpeace, he founded PowerShift, to which he served as the executive director. PowerShift was to be an NGO dedicated to driving the clean energy market breakthroughs and building the grassroots base to stop global warming. That's a quote. This goes to show, again and again, like everything, how these things are planned years and years in advance. Like, this stuff isn't happenstance. It's really, really thought out, and it's very, very strategic. And there's millions, billions, and trillions of dollars put into these very well thought out strategies to deploy the designs as sought by the empire and the world's richest families and foundations. So moving along, and I'm just going by, I think I mentioned this is a new piece, and my Ace Forrest Palmer, who I work with Wrong Kind of Green, is just doing a sort of a once-over of this before we put it out. So it should be available in a few days. But I'm just going to give you little bits of that out of this piece of writing. So you can just jump in any time or wait till I'm done. So the Energy Action Coalition, which I just spoke about, that was created back in 2004. And that was an umbrella group for about 20 to 30 NGOs in the vein of different groups that we've talked about before, like the Climate Action Network, Tick, 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 and scores of others, where under one big brand, they have a lot of power and influence. So anyway, the Energy Action Coalition co-founder, Parrish, he's cited by the Broward Youth Awards on their website as the founder and director of Energy Action, and that apparently was Earth Island's first project led by a Broward Youth Award winner. So even back then, that project was an incubator project. Moving right along, I just go on to basically to demonstrate how we create, like, the modern-day activist anthropocentrist of, you know, the 21st century. And, this article, for instance, is called From Stable to Star, The Making of North American Climate Heroes. And it's all about how they're conditioned and cared for and nurtured, you know, like very, very expensive horses, you know, in an elite industry. So anyway, I go on and I talk about these groups, and I talk about Parrish, how he's sort of plucked from Harvard at a very, very young age. Before the Energy Action Coalition, he had another group, and that group, and it's hard to find exactly where or why he was chosen or but by who, but it goes back to in 2005, for instance, he was featured in the Rolling Stone magazine as number one climate hero of the 21st century. I mean, we talked about that before, too, how Rolling Stone, you know, all these people that actually serve the elite's interests are all featured in these magazines owned by the very, you know, by the same people, but our owners. And it's not happenstance. I mean, you're really, really chosen to be put into the limelight. And anyway, back in 2008, in a book called Dissent and the Failure of Leadership, it talks about that. And in the book, the author argues that millennials are working towards small and achievable goals rather than pursuing radical systemic change. And then she describes the efforts of Billy Parrish as a really good example of this. And then she goes on to quote Parrish. She says, the next generation of advocates are solution-oriented. And he continues, they're interested in things like biodiesel, et cetera, instead of radical ecology of the 70s. So this is just showing the transition from radical environmentalism to where we become very, very human-centric and basically molded and shaped and cherry-picked by the elites.
So is this the job of the Green Corps and Opportunity Agenda? Is that kind of what they do? Is their methodology is indoctrinating these young environmentalists, quote unquote?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. They definitely nurture them, and everybody wants to be told they're amazing, right? And that they're doing good work and everything. So imagine these young, impressionable people, very eager, you know, they really want to do something that's going to help change things for the better. And they're immediately, you know, almost captured by these people and told they're amazing and, you know, said they're molded to please the people funding these organizations and funding these, what are they, like, you know, these little training centers.
Yeah, and how old was Billy Parrish when he dropped out of college and became one of the leading activists?
By the age of 21, he was managing a $5 million coalition of college-age environmentalists. And by the time he was a junior, he had 80 employees and was working with the White House on promoting green jobs.
See, it's like Bill Clinton said, if you work hard and play by the rules. Oh, wait. No, that doesn't matter.
I'm such a slacker.
Well, that's you guys a long should set have played rules. Better. You should have followed the rules.
I want to be told I'm amazing.
Give it time. Maybe you can get remarried.
Maybe.
Anyway, it seems through the research, I discovered Jamie Henn, John Warno, I don't know how to pronounce the last name, Bowles. Do you know? The head of 350 now? B-O-E-V-E? Anyway, however you pronounce May's last name, May Bowles.
We don't run in those circles.
they were all signatories going back to 2006 demanding construction of the wind farm in Cape Cod. So you go back and you see these same names over and over and over, right? And they're forming, like, basically the new movement of quote-unquote clean energy. So anyway, moving forward, the power shift, which is, you guys have heard of that, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's a huge thing, and that focuses basically on students. And to me, all the research I've done, like, to me, it's very, very clear that students today are the army for the oligarchs, you know, the chosen sacrificial lambs who basically, unbeknownst to them, and it's really unfair because they're manipulated and exploited They are the foot soldiers, you know, for the quote-unquote new, new economy and all the other things that the oligarchs have designed and waiting for us in the wings. And the power shift, that was a huge consortium of the PIR groups, and those are the public interest research groups. The executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, it was J.R. Helfen, and he's, what is he? He's the, actually, owner of the domain belonging to 350.org, and he is the executive director and general counsel of the Sustainable Markets Foundation that went on in 2011 and 12 to help finance the book and film project, The Message, now known as This Changes Everything. So again, it's just going to show the, you know, all these interlocking patterns, interlocking people, and this interlocking money, like how we keep this system, you know, cannibalizing all the upcoming activism, any types of real activism, and we bring it in and we make it, you know, we pacify it and make it palatable.
Let me give a quick example about that, and then okay. We have a caller on the line,
okay.
If you don't mind. Yeah. Arundhati Roy wrote in 2004, quote, "In the long run, NGOs are accountable to their funders, not to the people they work among. They're what botanists would call an indicator species. It's almost as though the greater the devastation caused by neoliberalism, the greater the outbreak of NGOs," end quote. And then Roy went on to endorse Naomi Klein's recent book. So talk about interlocking. First she sees it, then she doesn't.
Right.
So and I think what we're describing here has been described before as the arrogance of humanism. Our favorite species is the only species that really matters. We willingly destroy habitat for many species, ultimately including habitat for our own species, in exchange for a little power, a little pat on the back, a little perk from the people with real money.
Plus it's hip.
Yeah.
All these hipsters getting involved in you know, the new economy and becoming activists, and hey, I could land on Rolling Stone.
Right. Well, and you know, there was a book called The Arrogance of Humanism, published in 1978, written by a conservation biologist, David Ehrenfeld. I'm going to write about that book and the concept of humanism and its arrogance in an essay that will appear soon at the blog. But we do have that caller, Peter from Knoxville. Are you still with us?
Guy, you didn't cut your interview short just for me, did you?
No, we're begging for your cryptic question to which we can give a bloated response.
Oh, okay. My name is Peter Joyce, and should I call back? You're having an interview with the lady there. I want to stay on topic.
Corey is guest hosting this show with Mike and I. We're talking about the nonprofit industrial complex. I assume you had a question about that issue?
Yes. That I think you're all doing a great job. But I'm going to call back because I wanted to talk to Guy about another specific other things.
Okay. Well, we'll catch you on the flip side then. Thanks, Peter.
I have a question for Corey.
Corey, a member of the live studio audience, Brad, has a question for you. Ready for it?
Sure.
So, Corey, what's your take on Tim DeChristopher? How do you explain his escape from that kind of fate that you're talking about? He was a college student, you know, went into a government auction, bid, and in the process kind of became a celebrity, even going on to David Letterman. But then he spent 2 years in jail and now is in divinity school. He doesn't seem to have fallen that same path that you're describing.
Yeah, I feel I don't follow him. I think he's done some amazing things. But what I have seen from him, he's very, very torn. I think he has a lot of loyalty, and obviously he's a good person and a really, really well-meaning person. I think he has a lot of loyalty to the people that he's met who are part and parcel of 350.org and all the other organizations who he's worked with. So I have seen him do, you know, powerful speeches where he says, you know, like, I don't want to quote this because it might be not exactly, but he said things that similar to were maybe exactly sort of, we must kill the nonprofit industrial complex. Like, you can see at different types, different times. You know, we're all growing and we're all learning, and you can see that he has mixed feelings about it. And sometimes he comes out and makes those feelings, you know, he's very, very strong with those feelings, and he says a lot of really important things. And then I think he's sort of pulled back in, you know, because of those loyalties. So I think he's struggling with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, Terry Tempest Williams, the American writer from the West, recently followed Christopher's lead in bidding on oil and gas leases. And interestingly, she didn't end up in jail for it. So I don't know if we're relaxing the law because of who she is or because of DeChristopher's lead.
May I respond?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like there's a very big difference in that she has the ability to pay for those leases, and she has paid dearly in that she's going to lose her job. Mm-hmm. So maybe she's not going to jail, but
yeah.
The University of Utah is really threatening to take away her job.
Yeah. Imagine that, a university not. Oh, well, never mind.
We've actually asked DeChristopher to be on the show, and I was put in touch with someone who was booking him, and it went back and forth, and he was going to do it. And we just had to pick a date, and he never quite got back to me on the date. It went back and forth several times with this, I guess, quote-unquote booking agent. And eventually I got an email from Tim which said, "Michael, we previously exchanged contact information and wanted to see if you'd like to receive email updates on my work in activism. Tomorrow I am launching a new weekly email from my community of supporters sharing my work and ideas, including," and then he lists a bunch of things. And I wrote back, "That's great, Tim. We'd love to have you on the show because, you know, we've talked, you know, spoke several times with your agent, and you can express those things on our show," but I didn't get any reply. So not that I'm knocking the guy for not coming on the show, because plenty of people have turned us down in the past.
Yeah,
but
I have a word for those people to describe them. Wise.
Right.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and I'm reading into this a little.
No offense, Corey.
What might have happened was, and usually this is what happens, is we ask people on the show, they say yes, we ask for a date, and then they decide, well, maybe I should look up and see what this show is about. And then they listen to some episodes, and then the next thing you know, they're
coincidentally unavailable?
They're AWOL. Right. So that may have happened, or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
He could be a busy guy as well. I'm sure he is.
I'm sure he is. He's going to Harvard, is that right? Yes, Harvard Divinity School. So I'm sure he's keeping very busy. Corey, I want to quote you, if that's okay.
On what?
A Facebook email. Oh, never mind. No. There's this quote. Let's see. Lastly, to put this into perspective, how many people are even aware of the fact that only 5% of the world's population has ever flown? And, of course, sentient animals, insects, trees, plants, etc., have no use for solar whatsoever, nor have they contributed to the environmental crisis, nor are they placed at the forefront of what is most vital to protect. The most effective but obviously unpopular solution to mitigating the climate crisis would be the eradication of the 1% creating the crisis. So let's talk about that. That gets at the issue of solar and propping up industrial civilization by any means necessary, including convincing people that we can do things that are actually impossible. And so stunningly, we do them because we're convinced. And so, Corey, let's talk about that a little bit. Can you flesh that out some for us? Can you talk about the animals?
Well, that's sort of at the end of that article that I'm writing about, you know, Stable the Star. I just talk about that because that's the direction Parrish went in. I mean, now he owns, I don't know if it's some multi-million-dollar company. He owns a huge solar company, which is promoted and endorsed by Greenpeace and Bill McKibben and all the NGOs because he's, you know, he's done his part. I call that section the era of enlightened self-interest. And then within that, there's images, for instance, of, you know, little shows, getting into the green game. It's all about our highest priorities to return capital with interest to our investors. Well, how did that become the highest priority of environmentalism? to return capital with interest to our investors. I mean, now we've completely blended the lines. There's no lines between, you know, corporations, business, industrial civilization, activism. It's all blending into one thing here. Anyway, he founded the Solar Mosaic in 2009, and then, surprise, surprise, it turns out his father has 35 years of experience as a partner in several Wall Street law firms, and his principal focus has been in the field of corporate securities law with specialization in mergers, acquisition, public utility, and energy law. So again, it's talking about all the different people that bring in all these different you know, valuable assets to push this whole thing forward. The reason I wrap up, and then in the same section I have pictures of solar systems on top of McDonald's with Ronald McDonald up there smiling. You know, everything's great, everything's good. Pictures of huge, massive lithium mining pits that for some reason are, we just pretend don't exist, I guess. You know, look it up. Just like we talked about last time, lithium mining, and you're going to see stuff that will blow your mind. And yet, we pretend tar sands exist, but lithium mining does not exist. You know, all these things needed for the furthering and expansion of capitalism and industrialized civilization. So, you know, it really is denial and delusion. One of the last images, like in this photo gallery of the solar, is just, it's a meme. It's basically saying how solar energy in the U.S. military, that annual budget is $20 billion. And so it's the biggest energy consumer in the world. But instead of taking issue with that, it's a positive thing because they have a goal to get 25% of its energy from renewables by 2025. And to do that, of course, we'll have to go in and invade and occupy and kill millions more people to secure those resources. But we just, again, pretend that's a non-issue. And, you know, I have solar panels on my house. I did that, you know, back a long time ago, and I thought that was the way to go. And I've come since that time, you know, grown and learned and able to, you know, comprehend how that's not right. You know, it's not right taking all that so I can sit here and, you know, write on my computer and not at the expense of the planet. Like we said last time, I know people have lived for millennia without this power, but I know we can't live without water, without fresh air, all those things we need. You know, this way of life, we don't. And it's funny that we cling to it because we're clearly unhappy when you see how many people are drugged up by Big Pharma today.
Right.
You know,
maybe
so
talk
amazing.
A little bit about you wrote about this a little bit with your solar panels and your trees and the conflict you have with those two things. And
yeah,
you know,
like I come to really resent my panels in a way because, I mean, I'm creating energy, and I look outside, and three of my neighbors are blowing leaves onto the road, you know, so I basically, even though those panels were locally made of stolen resources from other people in other countries that had never taken anything from us, I'm sure, probably nothing, because they live with nothing, and I've had those installed on my house to feed an energy grid, to waste it. I mean, pretty much all of our energy is wasted. And so that doesn't make sense to me. And all the time, I love my trees, and I love all trees. And I'm always at odds because my trees are blocking and shading my panels. And so if I want to make use of the panels, which I've, you know, all those resources have already been taken from the earth and put in those panels, if I want to utilize that and not have it wasted, I have to cut the limb off the tree. Well, why am I cutting a limb off a tree when that tree's absorbing carbon and shading my house so I don't need air conditioning? You know what I mean? So instead of all of us installing solar so we can run air conditioners and leaf blowers and be on Facebook 20 hours a day and all the other stupid bullshit that everyone is addicted to and loves to do, why don't we plant trees, which costs nothing but does everyone, you know, just loads of good. And so I've had a lot of, you know, thoughts about that.
I mean, we were all indoctrinated at some level for a really long time. And so reaching the realization that we've been indoctrinated is a pretty significant step. I think it was Mark Twain who said it's easier to fool a man than it is to convince him he's been fooled. Right. So we've all been fooled by this set of living arrangements for a long time. You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're engaged in conversation with Corey Morningstar, and we're taking your calls toll-free at 888-874-4888. And Mark from Texas, are you still with us?
Yes, Guy. Is this the this is the radio show where people check into reality, right?
Sure, if that's what you want to call it. Long title.
Then I'm at the right. I'm at the right address. thanks, Mike, Guy, and Corey for doing the show today. I had a question. To talk a little bit about Woodstock, the concert, and I guess a little bit what happened after that, why it didn't keep going.
You know, I think two of the three people in this conversation were barely alive at the time of Woodstock. And I was like not even 10 years old. So I'm not sure you're calling on the right people for context. But
I was conceiving. I'm kidding, I wasn't. Sounds cool, though, doesn't it?
Wish.
I thought I had a smart question, but I guess it didn't work out.
It's a smart question. You just... looking for smart answers. That's the problem with calling this show.
Because there was a Woodstock follow-up which was co-opted and made corporate. That's generally what happens with everything. We were talking, if you look at any sort of, we're talking about the street fair in Tucson, which you know, my wife and your wife just attended, and I was at Potluck down the road the other day, and they were talking about how the street fair started. And one of my neighbors said, "Wow, yeah, it was just a place where a bunch of hippies tried to, you know, sell their shit." And now it is just blocks and blocks and blocks of booths. And one of the artists that was at Potluck said, "Yeah, it's about $600 to get a booth. There's insurance and you know, booth space and all that." And she basically said, "You know, it's a zoo, and I can't really afford this. I don't know if I'm going to make $600."
Right. So, a real artist, a so-called starving artist, can't afford the booth to sell their goods at this entity that has become corporatized.
Yeah, and what happened was, you know, a lot of the stores that were there, the business they were receiving were for people that just used to gather there. But then, of course, that became unpleasant looking, and so we asked those people to leave. And, well, we need to draw people in, so let's have a giant street fair. And it seems the way that, you know, things kind of go, like Burning Man.
Yeah.
Now it's pretty much sponsored.
Right. Yes, yeah, sponsorship at Burning Man.
Yeah.
We need to get a sponsor.
We do need to get a sponsor.
That's the whole problem with this show.
Right. Brought to you by...
I got 5 bucks.
That's not going to cut it. This is big time radio.
I have another quote that might trigger a little conversation with Corey and us. Adam D. Sachs says, "Because corporations must have physically impossible endless growth in order to survive, corporate social responsibility is a myth. The only socially responsible act that corporations can take is to dissolve," end quote. People can't seem to fathom a world without corporations or a growing economy, and those are one and the same, I would say. Are the vast majority of privileged people incapable of visualizing another narrative? I would say almost certainly.
I think a great example is our conversation last week, the solution-based conversation that happened in the second half of the interview. First half of the interview was about, you know, a radical step towards getting rid of nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, and the second half was voting for a candidate who is supposedly having a political revolution, and all the solutions were placed in front of us if we would just, you know, take solar and wind into our bosom and accept that this is the way out. That seems to be the narrative we get almost every week.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a solution if you just follow this lead. It's interesting that we were interviewing somebody who lives in Australia,
the only country in the world that has a larger per capita carbon footprint than the United States. And she was telling us we need to vote for Bernie and go to renewables to solve the problem. And last I heard, the prime minister in Australia was still pushing to sell coal out of Australia, and destroying the Great Barrier Reef was one of the consequences of that sale.
Right. So, Corey, this seems to be the standard narrative. It doesn't matter if people have been, you know, fighting the good fight for literally their entire lives. When it comes down to it, people cannot get past the idea of not living in a world where things are solved by corporations.
I was thinking about that today because I was looking at these images of Bernie Sanders and comparing them back to Obama. I mean, even though I'm not American, I'm amazed at how much the hype in America over the elections. Like, I just, I find it unbelievable. You know, the belief in the system still, even after Obama, I just find it amazing and incredible. And I was thinking maybe it has something to do, you know, with modern man for thousands and thousands of years of being storytellers. I mean, maybe we need stories. Maybe we love stories. And maybe we don't, we just, I don't know, don't want to look at truth. I mean, I'm looking at these images, and we've got Obama before, right? Saying change we can believe in. And then today we have Sanders, a future to believe in. So we've got the same caps, same font, basically, same words, same phrases. We've got red, white, and blue. We've got red, white, and blue. And so what this shows is branding. And what this shows is that this brand, even though the Obama administration, you know, they're, look what they've done. I mean, look at the millions of people that have died under their watch. I mean, it's incredible that this brand is so powerful that it continues, because if that brand was damaged, no one would touch it. No one would touch any of those words. No one would touch the colors. No one would want anything to do with it. So just the fact that this brand stands as strong today as it was back when Obama started, what was that, 8-9 years ago, is unbelievable. And it just goes to show we don't want the truth, even if we pretend we do, and we're happy to throw our brothers and sisters all over the world under the bus for what we want. And, and environmentalism is dead. It's all about what we want. And if, you know, we can throw a crumb here and there to a bird that happens to fly by, hey, win-win, right? It's such bullshit, and I just can't believe that today people buy into this. I mean, the system is a racket, and the Black Panthers had that figured out. I mean, you know, your last caller was talking about was Woodstock in the 60s, I think. I mean, they didn't ask for the state to feed their people. They fed their people, right? They did their own breakfast programs. They took matters in their own hands. They started organizing. Now we just want people to come in and save us. People, you know, we want our oppressors to take care of us. And it's incredible. So I don't know what you call that. Maybe we just love storytelling.
Well, one of our radical neighbors at coffee this morning suggested that our show be a little more upbeat, have a little bit more upbeat guests on. And so I told her we were going to have Corey Morningstar. That ought to fix it. But you're telling me you aren't going to fix it today.
Yeah, you kind of dropped the ball there, Corey.
Maybe next month. We'll give you another chance.
This is your next to last chance.
But do you guys know what I mean? Like, look what's happened under that, under the Obama administration watch. And there that brand is, just as powerful as ever.
You know, right after Obama was elected the first time, I was walking through a store and I saw this book written by one of these extreme right-wing guys. I don't remember which one.
Probably like Bill O'Reilly.
Glenn Beck or Bill O'Reilly. Right. It was called Brand Obama.
Mm.
And I don't know if you remember that, but I thought, well, that's a little extreme. I mean, that's right. Taking things a little far. And I look back now, holy cow.
Yeah.
Yes, it was strictly a brand. That was the whole show.
Yeah.
I mean, well, how could I have not been convinced otherwise?
I mean, the narrative is the same. This time it'll be different.
Yes.
That's generally the narrative. This time, if we can just get this person in, this policy passed, this piece of legislation through, things will things will change. Things will turn the corner. So, all right, Corey. Any last thoughts?
A parting shot.
A parting shot.
Our poor, tender, fragile guest listeners.
I don't know. I'm working on. I'm almost to the end now. The divestment campaign novel broken into. Let's see. Forrest is looking over part 14, and I think there's two left. And the final remaining chapter is about how technology as symbolism has replaced the iconic tree, which I think is, you know, a pretty massive thing. Obviously, I explained that in detail, but basically before we used to have this majestic iconic tree is the symbol of, you know, all things beautiful and good and in nature and our connection to nature. Well, that, now that's been replaced with cement and steel. You know, the symbol of the windmill or the solar has totally eradicated that tree. So that ties up that series. And the one that Forrest is looking over right now is all about basically divestment. If you've noticed, it's making huge strides, and the money's being, I mean, it's not really being taken out because the commitments are, you know, five-year commitments, but whatever is happening is sort of confusing. That's why it takes a long time to research it and write it and explain it, so it's very, very clear. But what I see happening with that is just like water, you know, that sort of the last hurrah to seize all the water on the planet, the privatization of nature, the financialization of nature that's taking place, that's to seize everything that's left. Scientists are saying basically we'll have used up all of our resources by 2030, hence the necessity to go to another planet. So we've got water, we've got everything in nature, we've got securing food with genetically engineered seeds, and now we've got oil and oil, gas, coal being taken and put into private equity investments. And I think that's going to play a big, big part. I mean, this whole renewable energy, third revolution, whatever you want to call it, that secures every drop of oil, coal and gas and everything else that's left on this planet. If nothing else, that ensures every drop is needed. I mean, can you imagine?
This series of yours has grown long enough that I think you could turn it into a book, and if you just finish each chapter with a happy little quote, you can make a lot of money and maybe turn it into a movie.
Buy a Tesla.
And start becoming the corporate sponsor for Tesla.
You too could be on Rolling Stone magazine.
People didn't know I want to read that stuff. I don't even know why I bother. I mean, it's just like...
Oh, we read it.
If you say anything about anything, it doesn't even matter what kind of proof you have. People are not mad at what you've disclosed. They're mad at you.
Really? You get to kill the messenger approach? Inconceivable.
You don't want to read a book like that. I can pay them to read the book.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. We'll talk to you hopefully next month. And cheer up.
Thanks, Corey. We very much appreciate your contributions, as always.
All right, Guy, you got a climate update?
I have a climate change update. Melting of Greenland's ice is linked to shrinking Arctic sea ice, according to a paper in the February 26, 2016 issue of Journal of Climate. Specifically, melting Arctic sea ice favors stronger and more frequent blocking high pressure systems, which spin clockwise, stay largely in place, and can block cold, dry Canadian air from reaching Greenland during the summer. This phenomenon enhances the flow of warm, moist air over Greenland, thereby contributing to increased extreme heat events and surface ice melting. This is more work from Jennifer Francis on the idea of this blocking high that has produced the polar vortex. A study published in the March 16, 2016 issue of Geophysical Research Letters finds that climate models commonly used to simulate melting of the Greenland ice sheet tend to, wait for it, underestimate the impact of exceptionally warm weather episodes on the ice sheet. The study investigated the causes of ice melt during two exceptional melt episodes in 2012, which occurred July 8th through 11th and July 27th and 28th.
During these exceptional melt episodes, which can be regarded as an analog to future climate, unusually warm and moist air was transported onto the ice sheet. During one episode, the researchers measured the ice sheet melting at more than 28 centimeters per day, the largest daily melt rate ever documented on the ice sheet. While the two brief melt episodes only lasted 6 days combined, or 6% of the melt season, they contributed to 14% of the total melt. Prime indication of warming ocean is coral bleaching, the third global coral bleaching event since 1998, and also the third in evidence ever, is underway on Australia's Great Barrier Reef. According to Australia National News, on March 28, 2016, a survey of the Great Barrier Reef reports 95% of the northern reefs were rated as severely bleached, and only 4 of the 520 reefs surveyed were found to be unaffected by bleaching. I've added this information to feedback number 26. Darjamail's climate change dispatch from last week's version of Truth Out perfectly spells out what abrupt climate change is all about. I'll quote from the article. NASA recently released data confirming that February was the warmest month ever measured globally at 1.57 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial baseline temperature average. The new record easily smashed the old global temperature record, which was set just 1 month before in January. This means that while it took from the advent of the industrial age until October 2015 to warm the planet 1 degree Celsius, humans have managed to warm the planet another 0.57 degrees Celsius in just the next 4 months since then, end quote.
Is it record-breaking good?
Record-breaking good. Must go faster. That's the American way. Must go faster. You can catch my latest webinar on April 20th, 2016. It's sponsored by Audio Solutions, and it's described on the blog at the bottom of recent posts. Apparently one of my biggest fans, I mean critics, so-called science educator Scott Johnson, welcomes any opportunity to criticize me, so he's forking over the participation fee just to taunt me. And by taunt me, of course, I mean deny the evidence I present. So I'm looking forward to this. It ought to be fun.
Scott Johnson, is that his real name?
Really? Come on. It's like Norm Jones.
All right, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please share the link widely and the information from this particular show or any show. And continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll interview author and professor of clinical psychology, Steve Iliardi. If you missed the show, make sure to find us on the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher.com, and make sure to rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our listeners, our studio audience, for cheering in their questions, and Afrozen for his music. Remember, until next time, remember the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you.